Hi, everybody, and welcome to another Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm joined by Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris.
And this week we're talking to Kieran Harty, who is CTO of Tintree Inc. Hi, Kieran.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Martin.
How are you doing, Kieran?
I'm doing wonderful, thank you.
Sitting in your office on the West Coast?
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us anyway. So this week we're going to talk about private cloud storage. Now, I think last time round, Martin, I talked about cloud storage and you very much wanted to put a definition to that. So I'll just define it again. So when we say private cloud storage, we're talking about stuff you might run in your own data center or a service provider might run on your behalf that does more than just a simple storage array would do, which obviously we know there are a lot of storage arrays out there. So we need to really sort of talk about what private cloud storage means and why that's different.
But we need to look at why it's different from a storage array, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Where the differentiation is.
So I think the good thing for getting you on, Kieran, is the fact that this is a direction Tintree's been pushing in. So obviously you've got experience of this and this is where your products are headed. So it seems like a good fit for you to help us, A, explain it, and B, talk about your platform.
Yeah. So if you actually take a broader view on it, and it's helpful to look at this from a standards-based definition of what cloud actually is. So cloud is obviously a term that's abused by lots of people, but there's a pretty good definition from a U.S. organization called NIST, which sets up or defines some attributes for what cloud actually means, and then we can apply that to the private cloud environment. And this is something that they apply to the public cloud, but as we'll see, it's actually applicable to the private cloud as well. So the things that they view as being the attributes of cloud are self-service. So that's something that you're very familiar with from using AWS. They also have the concept of measured service, and again, familiar with that from AWS and Azure, where you're actually being charged for what you're using, not something that's so common within a data center environment. Then there's resource pooling, and that's the ability to be able to combine resources together and view them as a single unit. Then there's elasticity, meaning the ability to be able to grow and shrink resources based on application needs. Then there's the whole concept of just performance that you need within that environment as well. So you notice I haven't referred to storage in talking about this, but these are things that need to be provided by the various different components of the infrastructure. So if you look at what's happened on the compute side, VMware is actually providing and Hyper-V is providing these capabilities for compute and have been for many, many years. You're seeing that on the networking side as well. So with things like NSX and ACI from Cisco, and you need to be able to provide that stuff on the storage side. And that's what we've actually focused on. But it's not something that's particular to us. It's really about providing those attributes of self-service, measured service, resource pooling, elasticity, and performance and automation, and doing that for storage in the same way as vendors have done for compute and they've done for networking.
Just to qualify that a little bit, performance is not technically a NIST definition, but I think it's nice to include it simply because if you're actually delivering storage as a service to somebody, you potentially want to make sure that performance is included as something you measure and something you quantify, because if you don't, it's not something you can charge for or differentiate in your service offering.
Oh, yes, Chris. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking performance is, but a lot of people, when they hear performance, they talk about speed, whereas performance is when we're talking in cloud, it is a guaranteed performance at a particular level. So it could be slow, it could be medium speed, or however you want to do it. It's not just about rapid I.O.
Exactly. So, Martin, as you're a user, and I come from the background of being a user. Why have we never managed it with traditional storage to actually deliver private cloud? And why has it been hard?
Why has it been hard? I think it was hard is storage requires a lot of infrastructure, a lot of upfront investment. I think to a certain extent, it's been the elasticity and self-service is probably the most difficult thing we've had. We've always had kind of a black magic approach to how you allocate storage and how you divvy it out. So it's not been well automated in the past. And storage only ever grows, so it never shrinks. So we're always dealing with a growing requirement as opposed to a shrink requirement. It seems to be fairly unusual for something just to balloon up and then come back down again.
That's a fair point. And I think I would say, so perhaps from your perspective, Kieran, you've taken a different approach, and you've effectively within your platform solved a problem that was probably a big issue within delivering scalable traditional storage. And that's the fact that we used to treat things as LUNs and volumes rather than actually looking at the objects that we defined, i.e. things like VMs.
That was really kind of the core innovation that we had, you know, back when we launched in 2011. And it's really in defining things using the right abstraction. So if you don't define things using the right abstraction, then you essentially can't automate. And you could do things like providing quality of service at the LUN level, but you couldn't do it for individual VMs or groups of VMs. And so if you don't have that foundation, then there's a lot of stuff that you cannot build on top of that. But that's really at the core, certainly, of what we do.
Tied to that is what I think we can call probably the elephant in the room when it comes to this sort of work, and that's forklift upgrade. That whole idea of saying, I have to come in with a massive team and migrate from one platform to another, and the real issues that that involves.
Yeah, so this is actually something that I would view that to a large extent has been solved within a virtual environment. This isn't something that a particular vendor solves. So what you get within a virtual environment is, if you're virtualized, then you have the ability to be able to move from different hosts, so from one vendor on the host side, but you also have the ability to be able to move things on the storage side. So the experience that we see actually is that you'll come in and you'll have a particular use case, and you'll move over a few VMs, or maybe it's 100 VMs in an afternoon. So I think if you're virtualized, the whole concept of forklift upgrade is largely kind of is not there anymore. And so that makes things obviously a lot easier when you're actually moving forward on technology.
One bit to add to that, let's start talking about some of the features that we think you should have in private cloud storage. And I think that actually addresses some of that forklift upgrade scenario. And that obviously, as part of that design, when you're building an environment out, you need to set attributes to your storage objects. It could have been LUNs in the past, obviously in your case VMs, that allow you to do certain things. So for example, we might want to automate a lot of the work that we do. We might want to make sure we can give quality of service to an object. We might want to do multi-tenancy to support many different objects, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we can pick out some of these as examples of features you need. What do you think are the issues with the way that we've done it in the past? And how do you think the platforms are changing to solve some of those specific requirements?
Yeah, so I think in the past, the way that you've done it is you set a policy on a LUN, you replicate a LUN. But what happened with virtualization is that rather than having a LUN associated with a single application, you have tens or even hundreds of VMs that are actually sharing a LUN. And that means that every time you set policies, whether it's replication or quality of service, then you actually you're setting that on tens or hundreds of VMs at a time, and it means you don't have the right granularity. You're not able to operate at the right level of abstraction. So what we do, and there are also other vendors that do this, we operate at the VM level. So you can set all the policies at the VM level. I mean, this approach is also taken by HCI vendors, whether it's VMware or Nutanix, where they also operate at the VM level. So that's kind of the way that I think allows you to set up these policies and also to be able to write the automation scripts and do the self-service that you actually expect to be able to do in these environments.
You touched on a very good one. So let's talk about the self-service side of things and automation. That to me seems like probably one of the most critical pieces that, from my experience, was one of the things that you would definitely want to do in a private cloud environment. And the reason I say that is because if I look back at the work that was needed to provision something that was given out to a host, I'd end up, in the old days this is a long time ago, a good 10 years ago, maybe less, you'd end up looking for the technology, you'd look for a particular place to place a LUN, you'd provision it up, which could be a script or it could be a bit of batch process to do that. You typically didn't have an API, so therefore you did it manually or you ran a command to do that. When it completed, you had to map it to the host. So actually, automation was incredibly difficult to deliver.
Yeah, so if you look at where the bar is now, it's really set by the cloud vendors. And within a cloud environment, the public cloud vendors, so if you look at it from what you get within AWS or Azure or Google, you use your credit card, you can deploy infrastructure, and you expect to be able to do that within seconds. And so there, you know, that's where the bar is set. And you say, you know, the scenario that you described is very, very far from that. So the only way that you can get to something that's similar to the public cloud experience is by doing things at the right level of abstraction and actually having everything doable by an API. And that's something that you can't really get done unless you have designed your architecture to be able to support that in the first place. Very difficult, I would say impossible, to retrofit to existing LUN-based storage architectures.
Oh, I debate that. I very much debate that. We have done a certain amount of automation. We're probably not in the seconds which you get with public cloud, but even within a traditional data center environment, I don't like to shout this too hard, but storage has become remarkably easy. We worry a lot less about array layout. We worry a lot less about even presentation. We can do one click auto discovery of hosts if we want to. So it's not necessarily seconds, but it's potentially minutes or half an hour. Even if you have a storage team and you can still get back requests in, or we can allow developers access to it. So I think that's less of a differentiator than it used to be. Well, certainly for a traditional business model, if you've got a very elastic workload where you're spinning things up and down, yeah, we're not there yet. But I think a lot of this is overstated, I think, within a public cloud environment.
Yeah, so I'll counter that with, we actually have quite a number of customers who are doing development. And development environment, you're basically bringing up and tearing down tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of VMs in a week. And there's no way you could do that using a conventional environment. So again, the expectations, I think, have gone up. I think if your environment is static, there are things that you can do. But I think the bar has gone up in terms of what you can do in public cloud, but also in terms of what people expect, especially on development environments.
So. Yeah, I think there's some architectural ways working around that and how you provision in the first place for your environment. You can work in a very similar way to a public cloud if you want, but just by start allocating big chunks of storage available for developers and they just throwing up virtual instances within, certainly with containers and things like that, that's not particularly hard to do.
I'm going to throw you two things there, Martin. I think as an example, didn't EMC do something called VMAX Cloud Edition at one stage? Was it called that? Where they basically put a wrapper around the VMAX? So in that sense, yes, you could automate, I guess, but it would be incredibly clunky and it wouldn't really work very well. And the other one I would say is I've recently written a paper for 3PAR on private cloud storage. So I do have to accept the fact that it is possible to take an existing, what you might call old platform, and automate it to a certain degree. But perhaps 3PAR has a little bit more advantage in some of its features than, say, some of the other technologies had.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily run my private or public cloud on a VMAX.
We can agree on that, Martin.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's pick another one. Let's talk about quotas. Because I think, Kieran, you mentioned this at the very beginning. You talked about the idea of measured service. Whether we call it measured service, whether we call it quotas probably being the way we might technically implement it on the platform, that's a requirement without a doubt.
Yeah, so I think actually one of the interesting things about quotas is there are actually different layers at which you might implement it. So we actually see quite a few service providers, especially, that are implementing quotas within the vCloud Director layer. Right. So there isn't even any need for something on the storage side. But you do, in certain cases, if you're providing access to, in our case, a share, actually provide you, or you have a need to have a specific quota associated with a particular share. So it kind of depends. And I think that space is evolving fairly rapidly, but there definitely is a need to be able to carve things up so that you're allocating different resources to different users.
So you mentioned different users. Clearly, one angle there, another angle there is multi-tenancy. Now, perhaps, Martin, in the old days, we might have done a lot of multi-tenancy through physically laying the data out, putting LUNs in a certain place, and manually managing a lot of that. But things like QoS have definitely changed that, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, but there's also multi-tenancy covers a multitude of sins, where you have the security side of multi-tenancy, which is very important, but also the noisy neighbour. I've had people in the past try to claim that there is no such thing as noisy neighbour. Obviously, that's rubbish. That's why we have Quoz on more and more devices. So how have you, if you got Quoz and such things in your arrays, Kieran?
Yeah, we do. So, and we actually have quality of service at the VM level. So you can actually specify a min and a maximum IOPS associated with individual VMs. So that was actually driven by our service provider customers, kind of as you'd expect. You know, that's something which is very helpful. It solves the noisy neighbor problem, but also allows service providers to be able to charge differently for different levels of service.
that I think is one I've talked about a lot, which I don't think comes up or doesn't get mentioned by people very often, and that's the fact that I might want to actually physically limit you to a level of performance, even if the box can do more than the level of performance that's being used. So, for instance, say I give you a certain level of I.O. in terms of numbers of IOPS, that might be a really obvious one, but for instance, if I was running all flash, I might want to limit you to a certain latency, because that would allow me to have an ability to charge you more if I can give your learn a lower latency. But people seem to not, there seems to have been always a thing in storage that people think we should always try and make it go as fast as possible, even though that isn't necessarily always the right thing to do.
Yeah, I totally agree, Chris, because one of the issues is certainly in a private environment, if you allow a machine to run as fast as it possibly can, even though there's not a requirement there, and somebody else does come along, and then so everything else starts to slow down a bit, you end up with a big customer expectation management issue as well. So it's not always a good idea from the infrastructure team's point of view to allow things to run as fast as possible. That goes for a computer as well, obviously.
I think it becomes very obvious, though, once you get into a service provider environment. And we're used to this, obviously, from our consumer world. Service providers want to be able to charge you for different levels of service. So, you know, they don't want to just give you the best level of service, because they're wasting resources if they're doing that. And you may not need it.
Okay, I'm going to give you another one, Kieran. And I think this one's a really interesting one, because this might talk to some of the features of your platform. And then after that, perhaps we can talk a bit more about why you think your product is a private cloud storage platform nowadays. And that's the one of the idea of federation. So I personally would look at federation and say what it means is I might have more than one physical array, and I can treat them as a logical group of arrays, and therefore I can move workload around between them, even though they might be physically separate.
I'd say absolutely define it that same way. And if you look at what's happened on the compute side, that's essentially the way it's defined, right? So VMware DRS is very widely used, and that essentially provides a federation of hosts, which does load balancing using vMotion. VMware tried to do, you know, storage DRS, which would provide the same capability on the storage side, but they didn't have enough control on the storage to really be able to do that. So we've actually introduced a capability, we call it VM scale-out. You can argue about the definition of scale-out. Essentially, it uses the model of a federation, where you actually move things based on the load or whatever space usage you have on an individual system. One of the things that's interesting is we use Storage vMotion, or the equivalent within the Hyper-V world, to be able to move things around. And Storage vMotion in VMware can actually be pretty slow because it goes through the host. So we've actually just recently introduced an offload capability that significantly improves that by a factor of 10 in the average case. So that model is really what customers want. They don't want to throw out their existing systems. You don't want a forklift upgrade when you're with a particular vendor to move from one array to the other. You want to be able to keep your stuff around and then evolve your system in a graceful way.
So we'll just touch on that very slightly. How often do people move their workloads around, do you find? I mean, do you see that sort of, do you get that level of information on your array to know that? Or, you know, are you able to sort of give some feedback?
Yeah, so basically what we do is we have a monitoring system, software monitoring system, very similar to what VMware does with DRS, which is, you know, reading the statistics on space usage, performance usage on a very regular basis. And then making a decision as to whether it makes sense to actually move one VM or even a set of VMs from one array to another. And so typically they'll run that, the customers will run that twice a day, and they may move things once a day or something like that. That's kind of the frequency. It's not the same kind of model as hosts, where you may be moving things hourly. It doesn't make sense to actually do it at that frequency.
Now's the, I guess, the million-dollar question is, we've talked a lot about the idea of what private cloud should be. You know, we talked about some of the features we should expect. And it's clear that I think a lot of the stuff is around targeting the right object rather than it being a physical object, a more logical object, and around all the automation and all those other features. But why do you think that Tintri can now say that their platform fits that definition? What are the new features? What have you added?
Yeah, so we've added a number of things. So one I've already talked about, which is the capability of load balancing and acceleration of load balancing. We actually have also added measured service for compute as well as storage. So you can actually do storage analytics or compute analytics at the same time as you do storage analytics. And we've also added integration with the public cloud so that you can actually send snapshots over to AWS or to a local object store, which is something that people really care about. And over the last few years, we've been adding, you know, extensive automation capability and also integration with technologies like VRO. So the proof points are really as to whether you, you know, meet the requirements that I talked about earlier in terms of, can you do self-service? Can you do measured service? Are you actually doing resource pooling for storage? And can the environment be actually elastic? And we've lots of proof points there. As I mentioned earlier, we have customers that are creating and destroying 100,000 VMs a week. We have one large technology company that has, you know, over 50 of our systems spread across three different continents, and it takes a few hours a week to manage that environment. So the proof is actually in whether you can provide similar levels of service as you'd get within a public cloud.
Okay, so what's the snapshot feature? Because I see a lot of people say, we can push stuff to the public cloud. And you think, okay, so I can push a snapshot, which to do anything with, I have to pull back from the public cloud. And there's always a lot of smoke and mirrors around what really you can do with that data once you've pushed it out of your environment.
Yeah, so basically what we provide is the ability to set up a replication target, which rather than being another one of our arrays, is just AWS, right? So we replicate again at the VM level. We deduplicate and compress that data as it's sent over, and then store it in a deduplicated and compressed format so that it just appears within the UI as a snapshot, which rather than sitting on a local array or on a remote array, is actually sitting in the public cloud. And then, yes, you do need to bring it back in order to restore it, but you're sending a lot less data over in order to do that. And it's expected in this particular use case as being the infrequent long-term archive of data, as opposed to something that you'd restore every week or so.
So it really is snapshot as a backup as opposed to snapshot as a usable artifact.
We would say it's, again, long-term retention. We don't define ourselves as being a backup vendor, but it's there are other vendors that use snapshots in this way. But, you know, the distinguishing feature that we have is the fact that these are at VM granularity and stored very, very efficiently.
And the only reason I qualify that is because more and more snapshots are used is you take a snapshot and then you can mount it or bring it up on another system, whereas use it as the host disks or however it is. This is just really aimed at retaining data. It's not a usable thing.
No, it's very usable. Actually, what all you do is you actually you bring it local and then you clone from it. So it's actually something that's, I would say, it's beyond being just data. It's something that can be manipulated as a VM object. So literally in a single click, once you have it local, you can actually clone it and it'll run it on a particular host. So okay, There's no copying of files or anything.
In what area is it sitting? Is it sitting in S3?
Sitting in S3, yeah.
Right, so if it's sitting in S3 then, theoretically, because S3 allows me to provide access from lots of different places because it's all web-based, I assume, therefore, what you could do, because I think this is where Martin was headed, I could push a snapshot of a VM there, but I could restore it from another system somewhere else in the world, and I could effectively say, I want to create a master, or I want to put a backup, or do something, whatever, however you want to use it. But I can actually put it up there and I could restore it back out, you know, a day, a week, a month later with a minimal amount of effort.
That's actually correct. And so there's no dependency on the original source array, right? So even if you lost that system, you could actually just restore it to another system or sets of systems.
Does that mean that the dedupe is global then in that sense? Because clearly if you're going to dedupe from one platform and rehydrate on another, the data either has to have metadata with it or some way of understanding what you've deduped and you're hydrating.
Yeah, it's not quite global. It's actually something that uses the fact as to, or uses whether it's based from the same snapshot. That's something that we use as part of our deduplication, but it's not a full global deduplication.
The reason I was asking that question for was obviously, imagine I put an image into the public cloud and maybe I restore it once and then I restore it again. Do I have to restore the entire image, or because I've restored an older version of it, will some of that data exist on my platform and therefore I'm only sort of picking the deltas up, the differences?
Yeah, so if you have something that's already there, then you would just be picking up the deltas in that particular case. Yeah.
So fairly lightweight, which is good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
One other thing that suddenly comes to mind there, actually, because we talked a lot about VMs moving backwards and forwards, is the integration with the way that people work nowadays in, say, private cloud. And I hate the term DevOps because it never seems to sort of describe exactly what it means for me, but I know you've done some work around automation and integration with things like Slack, which personally I was a bit negative towards initially, and I was struggling to see the benefit of being able to say something because I thought there would be issues with how it actually worked. But having seen it, actually, your implementation looks quite slick. So do you want to tell us about that and how useful that might be to people?
Yeah, so Slack, for those of you not familiar with it, it's a group messaging environment, so very widely used within DevOps or development environments. What we have, and this was actually, which came originally from a customer that we have in Japan, was the ability to be able to talk to a bot, so chat with a bot, which then is talking to our API. So you can do things like asking for statistics on a virtual machine. You can set quality of service. You can create virtual machines. And essentially, you don't have to learn a new interface. And you don't have to actually, you know, there isn't a complex UI that can be a learning curve for people to actually adopt. And we're actually doing some work now on extending that with natural language processing so that you can, rather than having to speak or communicate a fixed set of commands, it will actually be able to interpret what you're asking for based on the natural language that you're using.
Because I always think, looking at it, you know, somebody's going to say, create two VMs or whatever, and it mishears it and says, oh, create 2,000 VMs, and all of a sudden you've now got your environment taken down because somebody misspoke or had a funny accent like me or whatever, and therefore the system didn't quite understand what they were saying. How do you get around that? Because that seems to be my worst.
Well, Chris, I was going to say, Chris, I mean, you have to remember Slack is still a type thing, even if it's natural language processing in Slack, you don't necessarily be talking to it. I could see that going horrible wrong. There is, I'm not sure you ever come across it, where somebody says, they talk about a speech operating system, and it's asking where have I format, yes or no, and obviously because you've said that, because it's got speech in there, it automatically, the format commands, here's yes, and goes off and formats your hard drive.
The way you address it, so first of all, we're focusing on read-only operations first, right? So because people actually care about analytics, and there is concern over allowing this very sharp knife that you can really cut yourself on. The way you would address that issue is essentially for the dangerous operations, like creating large numbers of VMs, the Slack backend would actually communicate with a human. And ask whether it was allowed to do that. So that's something that we will be putting in this integration over time. But essentially, you really want to have some controls for dangerous stuff that you might want to do.
Right. I think you should definitely add something in there that when you do something you shouldn't do, it just comes back to you and says, I'm sorry, Dave, but I can't do that.
Yeah.
With all of that stuff, it all sounds great. So we've talked about the technology, we've talked about the features and all the rest of it. Ultimately, I think it comes down to two things after that. One is the ability to deliver things faster, which I think we've talked about in terms of automation. But ultimately, somebody's going to convert their environment into what might be a private cloud and certainly implement private cloud storage. There's got to be some sort of effect on the cost model. So from your perspective, how are you seeing what your platform would do change that model, and what are you seeing in terms of the way people are quantifying that and justifying that in terms of their sort of their migration to this private cloud storage model?
Yeah, there's actually two things. One is on the cost side, which is how many people do you have managing the environment, and what's the skill level that those people have, right? So so that's one element was the cost side. But then the other thing, which has actually been one of the big drivers to the public cloud, is how fast can you get stuff done? And that actually makes sense, especially on development. It's increasingly making sense when you're bringing out new products. And so trimming the time by 25% or 30% actually makes a difference. So there's really two measures. So what we see is that it's really the cost side is measured by how many people you have managing the environment. We will typically see, you know, a fraction of what you would have had to do within a traditional environment. So as again, earlier, the example that I gave, which was a few hours a week for a very, very large scale environment, is very, very typical. And those people were not storage experts at all. And we increasingly see virtualization people being able to manage the environment. And then the second thing is, how rapidly can I actually deploy my applications? And does it actually make a difference to, you know, how fast I can develop my drugs or how fast I can build my technology products? And that's really measured. Again, we see that where we've had a substantial impact on the turnaround time of building new products.
So, you know, you're going to really upset Martin, because you're really doing Martin out of a job by what you've just described.
No, he's not. You see, because you talked about your virtualization experts, and your virtualization experts used to be your storage experts. Storage and network guys are your go-to guys for virtualization. They already understand all this thing about noisy neighbors, quality of service, and how you deal with a virtual environment. So I don't really think there's a problem. I think it's the server guys should be more worried, because we're going to turn up in their space and show them how to do these jobs properly.
So, Kieran, one final question, which I guess is pretty much on everybody's lips these days, and that's how we go forward and we support containers. Obviously, in your current environment, you support VMs natively. Are you looking at having a position with containers?
Yeah, so containers, it's a very interesting technology, and we're getting asked about containers a lot by customers, particularly customers that have development within their environment. We've actually extended our model to be able to support container volumes, and that will be, it's in beta currently, will be available shortly. You can mix and match containers and VMs on the same systems. It's an interesting fact, though, that a lot of people are running containers within VMs, and they're also, in certain cases, running VMware's integrated containers. It's also, I would say, pretty early, though a lot of people are asking about containers. In many cases, they haven't deployed so much. So I would expect that this is going to be a lot more significant technology than, for example, OpenStack, but it's not going to be something that happens overnight. And it's also a better fit for new style applications, what people call cloud native applications, where you're building them in a different way than you would have what's being deployed on VMware or Hyper-V.
Maybe that would be a good opportunity to come back and have another conversation, because I think, you know, some of the things we've talked about around QoS, automation, all those other things are potentially done very differently with containers. So that might be a great opportunity to come back and have another conversation.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today. It's been really useful. I think from my perspective, it filled a few gaps, and hopefully it did for our audience too. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So everybody, thanks for listening again. You can catch us online at storageunpacked.com, and you can search for our LinkedIn page, which still doesn't have a decent URL, so we'll leave it at that and let you look on the website to find it. But anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.